Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Arthur McEwen, professor of economics and author of the book Neoliberalism or Democracy, who challenges the notion that there are no alternatives to free trade, deregulation of markets, and cuts in social programs. Janine Jackson, with the media watch group FAIR, who looks at why thousands of activists came to San Francisco to protest the National Association of Broadcasters' campaign to kill low-power radio. And Aboriginal rights advocate Isabel Coe, who discusses Australia's Indigenous peoples' struggle for civil and human rights as world attention is drawn to the Olympic Games in Sydney. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While attention is often focused on large U.S. corporations relocating just south of the Mexican border to avoid stricter U.S. pollution laws, threats to the environment elsewhere in Mexico are often ignored. One such problem is the nuclear power plant called Laguna Verde, located between northern Veracruz and the Gulf of Mexico. According to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, this plant has been endowed with antiquated equipment, dangerous procedures, and the full support of a government more interested in hiding the facts than in addressing the problems. The first hint of the dangers at Laguna Verde came in March 1993 and have come to the attention of the world through the efforts of Bernardo Salazmar, a radiation engineer at the plant, before he began describing its shortcomings. Incompetent and corrupt officials are destroying Mexico's nuclear industry, he stated. An anonymous group of engineers from the plant leaked a report to Greenpeace Mexico, decrying many of the same issues that troubled Bernardo Salas, things like plant security measures, radiation monitoring procedures, and a generally poor attitude toward plant safety. Mr. Salas himself was forced out of Laguna Verde after a series of incidents that began when he was checking up on Anatoly Kulichenko, a Russian technician who had worked at the troubled Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Kulichenko was emitting so much radiation that Mr. Salas initially believed him to be carrying a cesium source on his person. Superintendent Jose Torres condemned Salas as a bad element. Soon after, he was fired. Since then, Salas has worked at a number of temporary jobs in Mexico City. His family remains in the countryside, partly for economic reasons and partly for fear of reprisals. Over the summer, gay activists marched en masse in Rome to demand free sexuality in a free state. It was part of the controversial World Pride Roma 2000, where gays and their supporters defeated the right wing to win the right to march through Rome. According to The Nation magazine, gay rights marchers took on the Vatican and Italy's conservative political parties. Starting in April, the hard-right National Alliance, which took over the regional government surrounding Rome, demanded that the gay rights march be banned. Quickly, the Vatican and other conservative parties followed their lead. But Italian gay rights activists were undaunted. Amos Luzzatto, head of Italy's Jewish community, defended the march and reminded people that gays were also victims of the Holocaust. Suddenly, a flood of artists, playwrights, and movie stars endorsed the Gay Pride March. On the day of the march through historic Rome, a planned counter-demonstration called by the National Alliance was called off, and World Pride Roma quickly became a mass celebration of Italy's left. Yet gays in Italy are left in a strange legal position. There are no anti-sodomy laws, and the age of consent in sexual situations is 14 years of age. However, there are no laws protecting gays and lesbians from discrimination. As Sergio Lo Giudice, president of a gay rights organization founded in the mid-1980s by the Italian Communist Party, comments, "Invisibility has been the price of tolerance, but gays don't want to be invisible anymore." Decades of unexploded military ordnance at the 22,000-acre Massachusetts Military Reservation on Cape Cod was reported recently in Scientific American. U.S. Army veteran Paul Zanis spent the last 3 years exploring the reservation and photographing decaying grenades, rockets, and artillery shells. It was his photographs that spurred the EPA to issue a unilateral order forcing the military to locate and remove unexploded ordnance from the site. Chief among the EPA's concerns were the impact toxins leaking from the ordnance could have on the limited groundwater reserves available to Cape Cod. This EPA order marks the first time the military has been ordered to clean up ordnance for environmental reasons rather than concerns about safety. It's also the first time the order has been used to stop a source of pollution before finding it in an aquifer. Military officials have criticized the EPA, stating that the agency has no power to oversee military activities and that the problem of toxic intrusions from their testing sites is unsupported by scientific evidence. The implications of the EPA order go far beyond Cape Cod's problems. Unexploded military ordnance is of worldwide concern, as demonstrated by findings at the test range on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, and concerns have been expressed by parents who live near the U.S. Air Force's former Clark Air Base in the Philippines. There, children are developing leukemia, which many feel stems from pollutants that have leaked from unexploded shells. As EPA New England Counsel William Walsh Rogalski states, "Everything we're asking the military to do is reasonable. It just hasn't been done before." This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Frazier and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As bankers, corporate executives, and government ministers gathered in Prague for the 55th annual meeting of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, thousands of activists from around the globe took to the streets to assail these institutions' policies. This is the second time this year that demonstrators have targeted the World Bank and IMF, since tens of thousands of protesters attempted to block delegates from attending a Washington, D.C. meeting in April. Since last winter's landmark actions in Seattle against the World Trade Organization, a growing international coalition of labor, environmental, and human rights groups have criticized the bank's economic policies for widening the gap between rich and poor nations and exacerbating the poverty in which much of the world's people live. The World Bank and IMF have for decades operated under the economic orthodoxy known as neoliberalism, to which former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was once quoted as saying, "There is no alternative." Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arthur McEwen, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and author of the book Neoliberalism or Democracy. He challenges the notion that there are no alternatives to free trade, deregulation of markets, and cuts in social programs.
This idea that neoliberalism and extreme deregulation, no role for government, is somehow the only way is a very strange myth, because in fact no country that is now among the developed countries, the successful economies of the world, we might call them, got where it was by that kind of policy. The United States didn't get there that way. Britain didn't get there that way. Germany, Japan, indeed the real success stories of the late 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, Japan and then South Korea, got where they got precisely because they didn't follow neoliberalism. So the idea that there's no alternative is a very strange idea, and why that has succeeded in as a rhetorical device is something I don't quite understand. But aside from the rhetorical issues, it's quite clear that there are a number of kinds of policies that can be very good for economic growth, and at the same time, which deal directly with the social problems that are confronting the poor throughout the world. I would argue, for example, that it is possible to build an economic policy which is led by investment in social programs, investment in schooling, investment in health care, investment in environmental protection, and so on. These kinds of policies serve the dual function. On the one hand, they provide for direct needs of people. On the other hand, they expand markets. They provide investment. They provide demand for the private sector to grow. They create a population that is more equipped to work and be more productive. Now, it is important to recognize that in pushing these kinds of social programs, as I do, one can't ignore the private sector. I'm not talking about a socialist revolution where there is no private sector. That may be something worth talking about, but that's not what I'm talking about in the book. What I'm saying is that you can have a private sector and you can have policies which push social programs.
What do you think is the possibility that we're going to see some changes in the way these multilateral financial institutions operate? Do you see any kind of internal reexamination of the neoliberal economic policies that have come under such criticism? We've seen people like the chief economist at the World Bank, Joseph Stiglitz, come out publicly, and as you referenced before,
right,
critique his own organization.
It's important to recognize there have been some changes. These changes have come not because somebody in these institutions had a light bulb go on over his head, but because of the pressure of popular movements. The two areas where I think the changes in the World Bank especially are quite clear are, first of all, with regard to these large-scale hydroelectric projects. The bank has been forced in a number of instances to start to back off from some of the projects and is reappraising its role in many projects. Now, whether this is a temporary or long-term phenomenon is not clear, but it's certainly of significance. The second area in which I think there's been some change within the bank is the increasing recognition of the role, importance of gender relations in economic development and the importance in improving the position of women as a key factor in economic development generally. This was an issue that was totally ignored by the World Bank for many years. It came to the fore only because of the development of women's movements in many countries, which demanded attention to the needs of women, but not only to the needs of women, but to their important roles in economic development. So I think that the activities in Prague, the previous activities elsewhere, can take heart from these other successes. These organizations are sometimes forced to shift their policies, maybe not shift in exactly the way those of us on the outside would like, but I think there are some possibilities for change. I mean, I would like much more sweeping change. I don't want to suggest that the changes we've seen or the changes we can expect in these institutions are going to solve the problems. I think that these institutions, as they are basically defined, are part of the problem. They're not part of the solution. They are instruments for the application of the policies of the U.S. government and its allies. They are institutions that work primarily in the interests of the large internationally operating firms based in the United States and Europe. They're not going to solve the problem. Nonetheless, they can be changed. They can be constrained. And I think that's useful.
That was Arthur McEwen, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and author of the book Neoliberalism or Democracy, published by Zed Books. For more progressive economic analysis, contact Dollars and Cents magazine by calling area code 617-876-2434 or visit their website at www.dollarsandcents.org. A week before international actions denouncing the policies of the World Bank and IMF, thousands of media activists gathered in San Francisco to protest the National Association of Broadcasters' campaign to kill low-power radio in the United States. Last January, the Federal Communications Commission announced plans to establish hundreds of low-power, non-commercial radio stations in local communities across the country. This was in part a victory for activists who had established many so-called unlicensed pirate stations as a form of protest against growing corporate control over the public airwaves. But the National Association of Broadcasters, one of the most influential industry lobbies on Capitol Hill, and their allies like National Public Radio, immediately worked to defeat the measure. Their campaign has effectively killed the prospects of increased diversity on the nation's radio outlets. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Janine Jackson of the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, who discusses the protests in San Francisco and the power and influence wielded by the National Association of Broadcasters on a wide range of issues like campaign finance reform and media deregulation.
The FCC earlier this year decided to go ahead with what a lot of folks had been hoping they'd do for years, which was to legalize low-power radio, or micro-broadcasting, as it's called. These are hundreds and possibly thousands of small stations that could be from 10 to 100 watts. And if you to get an idea, that might be a 100-watt station might cover a 3.5-mile area. But they were really going to bring non-commercial new voices to the air. So folks were very excited when the FCC decided to go forward with this plan. Unfortunately, right after that news got out, the National Association of Broadcasters began pressing very hard for legislation to drastically curtail low-power radio. Some would say even kill it. They put forward something in the House which was called very disingenuously the Radio Preservation Act. This was something that the NAB pushed very hard for, and it actually passed the House in April. And in fact, as we speak in late September, there is a Senate version. It's Senate Bill 3020, and that's going to be voted on pretty soon in the Senate. And this is basically to roll back this idea of adding these new and non-commercial voices to the air. So the low-power radio activists are pretty up in arms about it.
So what happened in the streets of San Francisco as these conventioners got together to craft their agenda for the next year?
Well, there were a series, about 4 days' worth of events, press conferences, also some teach-ins and panel discussions, and also some direct action. We saw hundreds of folks on one day in front of Moscone Center, where the NAB was having their convention. Those 100 folks marched from there to Clear Channels Communications, one of the largest radio companies in the United States, to one of their offices. There were a few arrests along the way of protesters for things like pedestrian blocking the crosswalk type of things, including Steve Rendell of FAIR, who was arrested. But the activists were chanting and were also leafleting and trying to get some information out about what the NAB was doing. And then the following day, on Saturday, there was a large rally right there in downtown San Francisco. That involved over 1,000 people who listened to speakers talk about the NAB and talk about various issues that the NAB has been active in, not just low power, but also thwarting campaign finance reform and free airtime for candidates, and just in general, the NAB's role in perpetuating this commercial, advertiser-driven model of broadcasting.
One of the targets of the protesters was National Public Radio, which itself was holding a meeting, an important meeting in San Francisco. And I believe there was some kind of dialogue between protest organizers and NPR officials. Would you want to tell our listeners about that?
That's correct. There was a press conference by some of the low-power activists right in front of the National Public Radio where they were having their board meeting. And in fact, they were invited, the protesters, some of them were invited to address that board meeting, which was pretty interesting. And the protesters were upset because folks may have looked to NPR to promote the idea of new and non-commercial voices getting onto the air such that low power would provide. But in fact, NPR has come down on the wrong, if you will, side of this, an unsuspected side, and in fact have themselves been staunchly opposed to the idea of low-power radio. So there was a beginning of a dialogue there, hopefully, but as far as we know, NPR is sticking to their stance of opposing micro-broadcasting.
You mentioned just a moment ago the power of the National Association of Broadcasters in terms of their, decisive role in selling airtime to politicians come election years. And what's the story with the NAB and their blocking meaningful campaign finance reform? There's some kind of conflict of interest afoot there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the Center for Public Integrity released a report recently showing just how much money and how much effort the National Association of Broadcasters has invested in the recent years in thwarting any kind of meaningful campaign finance reform. It's something like $11 million in just recent years. And there's a reason for this. Lots of folks think it would be a good idea as part of campaign finance reform for candidates to have free airtime on television. But if you think about it, media and media companies, that's not really in their interest because, as a matter of fact, a lot of the soft money that we hear about in election cycles, a lot of that soft money goes to media companies to pay for paid advertising. So the media companies are really not interested in free airtime because, as Center for Public Integrity pointed out, they stand to gain some $600 million in paid political ads in this year alone.
That was Janine Jackson with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Contact FAIR by calling area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at www.fair.org. While throngs of people and media from around the world have gathered in Sydney, Australia, to cheer their nation's athletic teams competing in this year's Olympic Games, little or no attention has been paid to thousands of Australians, both white and Aboriginal, who have turned out to demonstrate against what they say are the corrupt practices of the Olympic Committee and the negative impact the costly Games will have on many of Sydney's residents. Leaders of Australia's Aboriginal rights movement are also attempting to take advantage of the Olympic spotlight on their nation to inform visitors and the world about the suppression of Indigenous rights and discrimination they say has been perpetrated by past and present governments. Between the Lines, Ruben Abreu recently traveled to Australia and spoke with Isabel Coe, an elder and veteran civil rights activist who helped establish a tent embassy in Sydney's Victoria Park. She speaks of the changes that have occurred in the Aboriginal rights movement since the first protest tent encampment went up in Australia's capital, Canberra, 28 years ago.
The unity that we had 28 years ago is certainly not there. There's so many divisions, but the divisions are deliberate. They're put there by the government. Only about 5% of our people actually benefit out of the native title. So you've got reconciliation. And that's mainly about, it's just a feel-good exercise for white Australia. They get to feel good and we get to feel worse. And the thing is, it's another way of diverting away from the real issues and the real problems and what this is all about. And it's about Aboriginal sovereignty, and which means that we own from one end of our country to the other end. We've never ceded sovereignty to our country. There's never been any treaties signed here. They came here 212 years ago and planted a flag and called our country Terra Nullius, which means empty country, and then set about to empty it by every means possible. And that's what the Aboriginal Tent Embassy is about, is to tell the true story about what's happened in our country, about the genocide that was committed right back then and the genocide that's still happening now today.
You know, when we use the term genocide, at some point I'm sure it was a very physical genocide. Some of the things I've seen in my travels, brief as they have been in Australia, is that there's a more insidious side to genocide, a spiritual genocide, that people, the Aboriginals, may feel totally disconnected from their land because of the policies.
Well, that's all a part of it. That's why they rounded all of us up and put us on reserves, missions. Concentration camps is the only way that I can describe them. And every aspect of your life is controlled on those reserves, missions, right down to what you ate. And now as a result of all of that, the diet and that we were fed, a lot of majority of Aboriginal people are dying. In 212 years, we've gone from being probably one of the most healthiest race of people in the world to probably the unhealthiest. See, we've got one of the highest infant mortality rates here. Aboriginal people are 30 times more likely to die than non-Aboriginal people. I believe that the average age of Aboriginal men is 35 years of age. They said it was 35 years ago, age 10 years ago, and the deaths have increased. So I reckon it's probably even lower. And with women, it's 45 years of age. And they waste billions and billions of dollars. They pour billions and billions of dollars into Aboriginal affairs every year. And there's something like about only in total right across Australia 400,000 Aboriginal people. So I'm not a mathematician or an accountant, but a lot of things don't add up to me. Now, one of the things that the Aboriginal 10 Embassy want to do is that these white people, this country, the government have led them all up the tree, the reconciliation tree, and we want to make the process right. We believe that people have to learn from the past. They've led the people up the tree and then they've cut it down after them. So they've done away with the legislation here, this reconciliation legislation. We believe that the only ones that should be reconciling in this country are Aboriginal people, because we're the only ones that were here, the only ones that were connected to each other. We were never connected to white people. They come from another country. And if there was a connection or a marriage of a sort, there was a shotgun wedding. The embassy is about Aboriginal sovereignty. It represents all Aboriginal people. It represents the Aboriginal nations of Australia. And that's what we hope to remind this country and the world, that this isn't about reconciliation. This is about Aboriginal sovereignty.
An awful lot of money is being spent in these last few years on the games. What do you think? Is there justice to spending that kind of money on the games?
Well, I don't believe there is. I think that there's a lot of corruption that's been involved with these games. I believe that the Olympic Games are supposed to be all about peace, and China missed out on the games, and Australia got the games because of China's human rights record. And the thing is, see, none of us were able to get over there and say, well, what about Australia's human rights record? And the thing is, see, the war is still continuing in this country. So there's the Olympic Games that are coming here while the war still continues.
That was Aboriginal rights activist Isabel Coe. For more information on the Aboriginal rights movement, visit the Anti-Olympic Alliance website at www.cat.org.au/AOA. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.